welcome to episode 7 of Valhalla Conversations, where I, a self-obsessed Viking fanatic and Norse myth nut, get to talk to lots of Norse creatives, people who either know the subject inside out through academic study, or have actually used that knowledge to create art in different mediums, from comics to films to TV series and, of course, books, as you may have guessed from my bookshelves behind me. In today's episode, I am delighted to welcome one of my favourite comic book artists and writers of the day, Asa Wheatley. Let me just check I am pronouncing that name correctly.
Yeah, perfectly.
Fabulous.
it is a bone of contention sometimes, but perfect pronunciation.
Thank you very much. It's always good to get names right from the get-go. Asa is the wonderful writer and creator behind not one, not two, but three volumes of Shield Maiden comics. They were funded and created especially on Kickstarter, and I've also met the lovely man himself at Thought Bubble Comic Con several years running. Come to Harrogate, it's in November. You meet him there, get your book signed. It's brilliant. But yes, Shield Maiden, as the title suggests, is all about a woman who can wield a sword as well as a shield, although in some cases she does also wield a spear and an axe, depending on who she's fighting and what's available.
Very versatile with the weapons.
So I guess for viewers and dear listeners who are new to the wonderful collection of comics and artists that you've worked with a whole host of, we might as well start with the beginning. And how did your work on Shield Maiden begin?
So originally, I think I've got the kind of startings of it somewhere, but originally, so I went to university for film and TV production. I studied that for a few years. And at the end of that, when I was kind of thinking that, oh, do I want to direct? Do I want to write like films? Do I want to kind of move into that industry? I started writing a short film, which eventually would become one of the stories in the first book, the bounty story. So that's kind of how it started. I always had loved Westerns, mm-hmm. and I always had really enjoyed kind of like Viking history and like Norse mythology. And I wanted to do both, but couldn't. Because doing one, like especially like short films, I mean, it's kind of the same with comics as well, but especially with short films, funding that kind of thing for one of them would be hard enough. So instead of doing them separately, I just kind of put them together. I took my love of both kind of things, the Western genre and then also like the Viking kind of setting, put them together, started writing something. It didn't really go anywhere. I had the kind of basis of an idea and then I put it down for a bit. When I moved away from kind of like film industry stuff, and I think I picked it back up again a couple of years later, and I thought, oh, maybe I can like write a book. My writing's not good enough to write prose. I'm too lazy sometimes. And so I started writing comics, which has always been a love of mine. The first thing I wrote was Tales of Mystery, which is a noir book about a private detective that gets trapped in the body of a black cat. And so that was kind of how I started making comics, realized it was doable, and I really enjoyed doing it. And so I kind of picked Shield Maiden back off the shelf and was like, oh, what can I do with this? I've got this one short story. Is this enough? And then I kind of thought, oh, what if I did it where it's kind of that one character but multiple stories in both a very kind of comics way, because there are a lot of things like that, but then also in a very Viking way with the kind of like sagas, and here's a story about this person, and then here's a story that's totally unconnected, got nothing to do with that first story, but it's about the same like character, or it's maybe them 30 years later or something like that. And so I quite liked that idea, and then transferred it slowly but surely into making the first book.
Wonderful. And did you always have an interest in Vikings mythology?
Yeah, I think so. I think it kind of like everything that I'm interested in, it has its hills and valleys. Sometimes I'm really, really interested in it, and sometimes it's just in the background, and it kind of just like dips between. I think obviously especially since writing Shield Maiden, but in the kind of lead up to that, when I first kind of came up with the idea, that's when I kind of got into it more and more, started reading like more about it, more of the like sagas and the like mythology and stuff like that as well, and just how insanely weird it is. I especially like that element of it. It's very, very strange and not straightforward, which is kind of a blessing and a curse. It's a very much an attraction because I like that kind of stuff, just stuff that's like weird. But at the same time, it's kind of like, wait, what is going on? Like, who are these people? Why has this person changed 7 times or whatever? So I've always had some kind of interest in it. It just depends how in deep I've been. But writing the book, I've definitely gotten more and more like in and learned a lot along the way as well, which has been fun.
Wonderful. So how did you go about setting up with so many wonderful, talented artists on Volume 1?
Wow. So Volume 1 was probably maybe the easiest. I'm not sure. It was back when social media was actually good and useful. And I found, apart from Sammy Ward, who is my partner, so working with her was very easy, and connecting with her was very easy.
Just have to say please.
Everybody else was either somebody that I had found online via Twitter or like call outs and that kind of thing, or somebody that I had worked with on a previous book. So there's a lot of crossover between the first Shield Maiden and another a horror comic that I did called Campfire Stories. Again, it's an anthology thing. I did a lot of anthology comics. I found that it was a good way for me to get something out more quickly and work with a variety of different people, where I could write kind of 4 different short scripts, send them all to artists at the same time, and everybody works all at the same time. And so instead of waiting months or like years for kind of a full complete like issue or book or whatever, because everybody's working at the same time, is they're only working on 5 pages or so, or 10 pages, but then suddenly you get a 50 page book because everybody's done it all at once. So I really liked that, and it was a way for me to easily get stuff made. Especially in indie comics, it can be quite difficult to have a continuing series with the same team all the way through. And so I found doing that for Shield Maiden, I kind of just picked up some of the people I'd already worked with, who I knew I liked working with. And then otherwise, the rest of the people I just found on Twitter, contacted them, and was like, this is what I got. Would you like to work on it? And it worked out. And that's kind of how I've continued to do it ever since. I mean, I've got a list of, like, every book I do, I write a list of people I would like to work with. And then some of them I tick off and some of them I just save for the next book. So it's quite a nice way to do it. I feel like I'm never going to run out of people to work with.
Well, I think it's worked wonderfully, especially with the episodic time jumping about timeline that you've set up from the very first book, which has about 4 or 5 stories in it. And then the volume 2 has just the 3, but slightly longer. Volume 3 also has 3, but slightly longer in length. And it's just nice to see those different art styles following the same character, but at different points in her life, because it really does treat them as different times, different viewpoints, different experiences, because some of them you see kind of like some of her witty side, some of her humorous side, like romantic side, but she's kick-ass in nearly all of them, really.
Yeah, that's the theme running through everything. I think as well, this is not something I thought about beforehand, but I now retrospectively think, oh yeah, that's a great like selling point, an idea that I can't kind of take credit for. But I think the idea, especially with like Viking history, because so much of it was like just spoken rather than written for like so long, and a lot of it is about like how Viking history changes over like the years, because it is just, it's spoken and stories change as people say them, like one person tells another person, tells another person, doesn't it? And the story changes. And so I thought it was really interesting reflecting that with using different artists for each story, that although you know it's the same character, she might look slightly different in every story because it's like another person is telling that story. Although I'm writing all of them, the artist is bringing their own version of that character in the same way that somebody told a story and then they tell the same story might bring their own embellishments to it. But that was something I only realized after doing the book.
Well, of course, I've loved all three, and I've happily thrown money at you every time you've launched Kickstarter for volume one and volume two and three. And of course, got these lovely exclusive A5 prints. I've got some of them on my wall, dear viewers, so you can't see all of them. There is more lovely artwork. I was going to ask, a lot of volume one and volume two seems to be more historically setting, and then it's really just a tip at the end of volume two, I think, and a big chunk of volume three is where the mythology starts blending in a little bit. So in terms of the historical settings and stuff, because there are a few places and names, in particular, I think it's in volume two, we meet Cain Asa of, I'm going to say Denmark, and you're probably going to correct me and tell me it's Norway. Am I right or am I wrong?
I think it's Norway. I don't have my notes.
There's not a lot of queens, and they always get them mixed up. But you've got a nice little insert at the end explaining how you came across Queen Asa as a historical figure and why you've ended up using her in quite a significant way with the life of the Shield Maiden. Would you mind telling us more about that?
Yeah, of course. So kind of on top of that, the kind of element of adding kind of historical, like pre-established historical stuff, especially for like Viking history, like we talked about, is a lot of it is very just spoken down, and so there's a lot of Viking history that is not necessarily 100% correct or is interpreted by different people in different ways. And I think that's a really interesting thing for a writer to come into, to be able to be like, okay, well, here's this story about this person, but there are four different versions of the same story. So it doesn't necessarily mean that I can't just make a fifth version. And I quite like that it's a little bit of freedom, and it's a little less. Obviously, there is some stuff that, yes, historically accurate is still important to a degree, but I think especially for fiction and for Shield Maiden in particular, for like my writing, I want it to be somewhat historically accurate, but not let it worsen the stories or the book. I didn't want it to impact too much. And so, yeah, finding Queen Asa and looking at that kind of history and seeing how she's like possibly the one of the bodies on the Osberg ship and possibly like related to Harold Fairhair and all that kind of stuff, I just thought was really interesting. But that actually came about because I discovered her, because as you know, and as your viewers might know if they've seen the title, our names are spelt exactly the same. She has a little overring over the first A, which I think, I don't speak any Scandinavian languages, but I think it gives it more of a Asa rather than Asa. But that's just not historically or linguistically accurate. But I was fascinated that I had the same name as somebody who could have been important in history, having such a unique name. And so I originally found her because I was going to write a little zine about people with the same name as me. So I was just, it was just going to be like a small little thing, something that I could do just kind of written, and maybe a couple of, like, get work with a couple of artists, get one or two illustrations, and then just publish it. Having a slightly more uncommon name, it is always interesting to see the other people who have it. It seems to be throughout history and countries a fairly unisex name. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of kind of different sides of people who had the same name. And then I stumbled across Queen Elsa, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I kind of looked into learning more about her, realizing there's not actually that much. There's kind of little bits about maybe where she came from, her start. So the story that's in book two is the kind of main story that there is about her, that she was taken by this other king of a different area, and he basically kind of like took her for his wife. He already had another child, but they had a child together. And then the story goes that she kind of enlists maybe like a servant or a slave to basically help her escape. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if that's Shield Maiden instead? And so I tried to keep most of it the same, but then just was like, okay, where does Shield Maiden fit in? And with the kind of the general look at how I put historical and mythological stuff in the Shield Maiden books as well, it is a lot of about, okay, what's interesting, and then how does Shield Maiden fit into that? And I don't necessarily think, oh, Shield Maiden won't fit into that, so I can't include it. I just worm her in and find a way to put her in, as long as it makes an interesting story.
Well, they are certainly all interesting stories, and that one in particular was really kind of nice, because it sees the Shield Maiden not fighting for silver, or indeed for kind of like for glory. She's fighting of her own choice, and of course out of love, because there is a relationship that blossoms between her and Asa, which I think was a really nice touch, because we kind of like always think, of course, it was just always man and woman in the Viking Age, but we don't really know, because the sources are so mixed and always written by people centuries afterwards, and those who are literate and those who are in power and hierarchy positions more than the common folk. So we don't really know how diverse their relationships were. But thinking of, in terms of the history, because I know she goes to a few different places. I know I think it's in, I'm going to say either the volume one or volume two. I did reread them all this morning, dear viewers. I did reread them all, and they are just as brilliant as I remembered. But there's so many stories. And because the timeline jumps, you can't always quite remember either which volume it's in, let alone what year she's in. Yeah. But I think she sails with a group to East Anglia.
Yes, that's in book one.
Book one.
Yeah.
Yes, and of course, did you base that on kind of like the start of the great heathen army invading, or was it just a very nice, convenient place? Because of course, a lot of that side of the UK has history with the Vikings.
Yeah, so I mean, there is a lot of, although I haven't intrinsically included the great heathen army in any of the books yet.
Ooh.
It will probably come at some point. I've got a little timeline of a kind of big important Viking history events and where they fit in with what I've done so far, and so there's always a chance that I will, and that Great Heathen Army is something that's so big I kind of can't not include it. I think I'm gonna have to do it at some point, but yeah, that one in particular I think is set a bit earlier, and is more the kind of smaller raids that are going over. But that is that's also an example of kind of stories following on from each other, because that story ends and leads almost directly into the Queen Elsa story in book two, but was not necessarily something that is super obvious until you maybe look at the timeline or read kind of some of the post story descriptive, like backup material stuff as well.
Yeah, It's certainly kind of like, I do see the threads now forming the very intricate and complicated tapestry that you've woven for this wonderful character. Because one of my favourite stories in volume one is, and I'm going to quickly look at my notes, dear viewers, give me a second. A Matter of Fate Kevin Keane, because I just quite like the element of introducing her with a seeress, a prophetess, kind of like the Norse believed in magic and all sorts, and quite often it was a female's domain more than a male's domain. And that hints ever so vaguely until you kind of like reach the end of volume three about the special quality that the Shield Maiden has, and I'm trying really hard not to spoil it. But also she and the seeress have another adventure, not equally as dramatic, but not as dramatic as that one, I think.
Sure. Yeah,
in
yeah.
Volume 3, so you kind of like see them in another part of their lives together. And equally, you do kind of acknowledge the Earthblood burial quite nicely in Volume 3 with the passing of Queen Acer.
Yeah.
So I really quite liked that. But in terms of the mythological stuff, there is a story in here called A Humble Shipbuilder, or The Quiet Shipbuilder. And it actually made me think back to your discussion about your name and how unique it is, because, of course, in all three volumes, we never actually hear the name of the Shield Maiden. She's just always addressed as Shield Maiden.
Yeah.
Often in a kind of like a derogatory kind of like, I can't believe you can wield that sword kind of thing. And, of course, she proves everyone wrong. But in this one, that one story, she does actually take a name, albeit Sepher, which is a name I've not heard before. And does that have some genuine linguistic history connection to the Scandinavian language, or is it just...
Yes, it does.
Oh, good.
And you're going to now ask me what it means, and I don't remember. So when I was writing that story, so A Humble Shipbuilder is one of the earliest stories that I thought of. It was originally going to be in book one, but then because of, and as we dance around it, a certain specific quality / heritage of the character, I didn't want to include it straight away. So I knew that that was there from book one. And so I wrote a very early draft of Humble Shipbuilder. It was fairly different, but one of the parts of the kind of like Western genre, as well as just kind of like action in general, one of the parts of those genres that I really like is the idea. It's like the John Wick idea. It's the person who was a very deadly person, lives a nice peaceful life, someone comes in and messes that up, and then they live to regret it. That's a genre of film that I will enjoy forever, and is also very prevalent in westerns, and so it was why it's something that came to me like quite early. And so when I was writing it, I wanted to give her a name that she would take on, not necessarily what her actual name is, but a name that would reflect the time that she's trying to have there, and her trying to just be a humble shipbuilder. And if I remember rightly, and I should have looked at this beforehand, it means like peace or peaceful or something like that.
She describes it. Well, she describes it. You like her to say name. Those words.
It was something, because originally I wrote it and she had taken her mother's name. And then the editor that I was working with had said, oh, it's strange that she's taken her mother's name, who earlier in the books is very much a kind of, is a warrior, is where she gets her warrior kind of like lifestyle from. If she's trying to be peaceful, she wouldn't necessarily take that name. And so I kind of had to reevaluate what she
was
doing.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. I just thought of it as a like, oh, here's a like cool nod. She's trying to be someone else. But it is very much like, but if she's trying to be someone peaceful, she wouldn't take the name of like a great warrior who died in battle and would and is the reason that she is this traveling like warrior. So I think I did some research into like Old Norse names. I like to try as much as I can to use Old Norse stuff. Obviously I'm not a linguistic scholar, so some of it is probably wrong somewhere, but I try and use that kind of stuff a bit more than maybe just using kind of like modern Scandinavian names. And yeah, that was the one that I found. I think I had a list of about 3 or 4, and that was the one that I found that I think fit the best.
So we now know that you know what her mother's name was, and we do meet her mother briefly in a very cleverly staged, framed is the right word, story in volume one, where we kind of get flashbacks of her as a youth escaping some bad men who just decided to pick a fight with her mum for various reasons we have yet to learn. Her mum valiantly fights them off, but of course she's mostly wounded, and she takes up the sword and shield and carries on. But it also mirrors with her own passing, which is why there's such a timeline jump, because we see both her beginning and end all in one, which is very interesting. But we don't really know why her mother was fighting, who she was fighting, what her name was. So then if the Shield Maiden wasn't going to take on her mum's name in previous stories that you may have written that we have yet to see, do you actually only know her independent individual name then, if not from her mum?
The Shield Maidens? Partially.
Partially?
Because of Norse culture, Viking culture, and which is still kept up in Iceland, half of her name is dictated by her parentage, which is great for me, because that makes my life so much easier, because half of her name is chosen already, which is in book three. But the her first name, I have kind of like thinking up her fake names, I have a few things that I am flitting between. I know what it's probably going to be. But every now and then I think, oh, maybe this would be better, and then I kind of go back on myself and I'm like, no, my original thought is right. And because there is a character in a kind of lesser known character in Norse mythology that she was originally going to be based on. But I think, but as the kind of it went on, that changed, and I didn't really want to base on that. I so then changed that, and so dropped that name. Very much trying to dance around spoilers, but yeah, so I'm like 90% sure of what her name is going to be, but that might change.
That's fine. I like kind of like, because we're still, as readers, we haven't got the complete story yet at all, by all means, in these three volumes. And that is why I'm delighted to say, dear viewers, that he is now kickstarting for volume 4. The link is in the blurb below.
Very exciting.
Click on it, throw money at it, because I certainly will. And all sorts of goodies and stories to come. So will you be following the same format with volume 2, volume 3, of just having three slightly longer stories, or are you going to have more individual shorter stories?
Yes. So from book 3 onwards, so book 4 will continue. So book 3 has two main stories, two like slightly longer stories. One that takes place, so a Humber Shipbuilder takes place when Shield Maiden is a fair bit older. And Through Pain and Suffering, the one that starts with the death of Queen Alsa, takes place when she's much younger. And so what I'm now going to do, because I loved writing anthologies, I really enjoyed that element, working with different artists, but I wanted to kind of keep that, but I wanted to also move into writing more like ongoing stories. So from every book forward, I'm essentially going to follow both of those two timelines quite canonically.
Mm-hmm.
So each thing will follow on from the last, mm-hmm. And they will be a bit more closer and maybe a bit easier to follow as well, rather than having three wildly disconnected stories in time. Because I just wanted to write something that was more sequential and followed a single story. And then also, like we talked about, because in book one, I know where her story ends, which I did purposefully, because as a writer, one of the hardest things to write is an ending. Mm. And I did it immediately. And I know now don't have to worry about it. I just get to write the fun bit. I just get to write all of the middle and not have to think about, oh, how am I going to like wrap all this up? Because I've done it already. I just need to get there. Mm-hmm. So it's going to continue with two stories, a younger and an elder. And then there will be one shorter story in the middle. And that will be the same, my plan at least, that will be the same for all of the continuing books that I do. So every issue will be like that. It will have the younger timeline, the older timeline, and then a story in the middle that kind of takes place at anywhere in her life. Sometimes it will be a story that relates to one of the other two stories.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it would just be something interstitial that maybe relates in theme, but not necessarily in characters or in story. But yeah, so that's my plan, is to now all of the books will be three stories, two following a specific timeline each, and then one free reign one in the middle.
That sounds delightful, and I can't wait just for more. Just like, you've got my support and my money from from volume one all the way through. Because as I was talking to you before we started recording, I couldn't quite remember when volume one came out. So how long has it been now?
So I'm pretty sure the first book came out in 2020. So I think, I think I ran the Kickstarter in maybe May of that year. I then remember being at like the digital version of Thought Bubble that they did that year, and having book one for that, and then I did book two the year after, so that'd be 2021, and having it at the first Thought Bubble that I attended in person as an exhibitor. I remember having the first two books. So yeah, it was, I'm pretty sure it's 2020 was when it started. So almost a book a year, not quite, but almost.
That makes sense, because I've got a vivid memory now of me either holding my then baby girl or having her in my tummy when I got volume one in the post and was reading it, because I remember tweeting about it back when Twitter was a bluebird and not an X.
Yeah.
Even though it has the URL of Twitter. Well, I'll still always call it Twitter. I just kind of call it X.
Yeah, me too.
So, as I mentioned before, mythology definitely comes in with a bang in volume three. So going forwards, will you now be kind of like having a balance of historical events and mythological encounters, or will you be taking her more on historical timeline as she moves forward?
Yeah, I think it will always be a mix of both. It will be whatever the stories dictate and wherever I kind of want to take the character next. So the mythological, there we go, element of her life is very shown in book three, is very intrinsic to her, but so is the kind of historical element, because of her connection to Queen Alsa and those kind of characters. And so we've already seen a little glimpse of Harold Fairhair, albeit as a very small child, but there is always that in the background. And I think that's kind of what my aim is to just have both of them always kind of being there. Sometimes a story might take a more mythology based turn, sometimes it will be more linked to historical events, sometimes it'll be a bit of both. I think continuing through the way that I'm going to with the two like timelines, it might end up that one timeline is going through kind of like a mythology phase and the other timeline's going through a historical phase, and maybe they'll switch around, or they'll both be the same. But yeah, book three I kind of went in very heavy because they were all stories that all three of the stories has some kind of mythology to it, but they were all stories that I had thought of at least when I was working on book one and book two. But I knew I couldn't write them yet because I needed that reveal to happen. I needed to write Through Pain and Suffering first before I could write any of the others. So knowing it was going to be in book three, I thought, okay, well, let's go whole hog and let's just put three mythology-based stories in this one, because the first two books, there is like some historical-based stuff. There's some stuff that I've just kind of invented. It's a mix of places I've invented and places that might have really existed. I think, I mean, I know what book four is because I've written them and I'm getting the art in, and book four is definitely more historical than mythology, but there is that mythology always kind of hanging over like the character. And yeah, I've got a Word document of maybe like one or two lines describing a story. And I've got a Word document that every single time I go to write a book, I add to that document rather than take away from it. The document gets longer. So I've got a lot of stories to come, and some of them are very mythology based. It was definitely something that will be continuing.
Because without giving too much away, those viewers and readers who may be familiar with the Lay of Thrym, that has a slight appearance of sorts in this book, in not the traditional way. It's very outside of the central myth, but that's always been my favourite. So when I saw a certain character mention a certain god in a certain wedding dress, I was like, yes, I know that one, that's my favorite. So I guess that brings me on to my next question, is kind of like, are there any myths that are your favorite that you kind of like absolutely love, or do you just like all of them? Like, how deep did you go into reading all the great adventures and
that chaos? Is a good question. Your question is better than the answer that I'm gonna give. I think for the most part I will read like bits and pieces, and I'll just read like kind of Norse and Viking stuff for entertainment as well as for research. Mm-hmm. Although now it's always research, no matter what my intention is, it's always accidentally research. But I find that a lot of times it will be when I'm thinking about what I'm going to do next. The interstitial story, the shorter story in book three, about the wolf. That came from because I read an article or like a historical essay about wolves, and I'm going to spoil it a little bit, because there's no way to talk around it, and werewolves in Norse culture. And I saw it and I was just like, oh wow, this is something that I just like didn't know about at all. And there's so much of Norse mythology and like Viking history that, although I know some of it, there's loads that I have like no idea about, or what their view on this thing was, or and so seeing the werewolf thing, I was kind of like, oh wow, that's really cool and really strange and different. And so I was kind of like, oh, I've got to find a way to incorporate that. And it tends to be, a lot of my writing tends to be, I'll see something and then it will kind of like spark a little bit of an idea. And so with Humble Shipbuilder, with Thymir, I had the idea for Humble Shipbuilder first, And then he fit in as a good antagonist.
Mm.
And I very much enjoy his story with Thor and like the wedding and mm. And I kind of read a version of it I read it and it was kind of just like, oh yeah, and then it happens and then it ends. Mm. And he I guess moves on or
yep.
something happens and there's not massively a conclusion because he's not the more interesting of the characters.
Mm.
And so I was kind of thought, oh, what would his retaliation be? Mm. I found that. So I don't know if there's necessarily at the moment there's something that I would definitely go, oh, I want to include this.
Mm.
But like if I'm writing book five and that week I happen to read about a certain element of Norse mythology, or I read one of the stories, or I'm just kind of reminded of, mm. oh yeah, do you remember that time that Loki did this insane thing?
Mm.
I might be like, oh, that would actually fit perfectly mm. into this thing that I'm writing. So yeah, it's not necessarily a I'll choose them that far in advance. It will be mm. as I'm working on stuff, and I think how can I work in some mythology.
Mm.
Or I'll just read something like the werewolf thing and go, that's cool, I need to write a story about that.
Mm. I guess that's going to be my next question, kind of like how far in advance, if at all, have you plotted regarding book four, which of course is more or less, I presume, scripted at least and being worked on by artists, yes, which we will yeah. discuss at a in very soon. Don't worry, artists, I haven't forgotten you because I love your art. But obviously with your jumping timeline and you having to navigate that and make sense for you as the writer and then make sense for us as the reader, yeah. do you know what stories you might feature in book five, say, or book six, or are you just kind of doing it with one volume at a time?
So I have a loose general plan to 10.
Mm.
A lot of my writing, my plans differ from my final results. like we were talking about, book mm. one originally was going to include stories that are in book three. Mm. And there are stories that I planned for book one, but I still haven't gotten to yet. So it really does depend when I plan stuff, but I've kind of got the vague, more the thematic plans
mm.
up to maybe 10, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, book four is all written and I'm getting art in as we speak. And so that's all kind of sorted story wise. Book five, I have plans for because of, like you say, the kind of, mm. especially in the first two books, the timeline isn't necessarily always as clear as it is in the third book, which is exactly why I put a literal timeline in the third book, because I have a like an Excel document where I have the Shield Maiden's life timeline written mm-hmm. out and marked by books, and that kind of, oh, this happens in book one, this is a thing that happens in like actual Viking history, here's a moment that I want to get to but I know
mm.
is important but I just haven't got to yet. So yeah, so I have a personal timeline to so that I can keep track, because I don't think I would be able to otherwise. And yeah, in terms of, so yeah, four is done on my part
mm.
pretty much. It's just art and then it'll be letters. Mm. Five, I have an idea of the stories that I would like to put in,
mm-hmm.
but if while I'm working on them something more important in terms of the character
mm.
kind of like pops up, or I think about should be there, then that is what I will kind of shift it to. Mm-hmm. It has made it slightly both easier and harder knowing that the stories are going to more directly follow on from each other. Mm-hmm. Because in the first two books, I had the luxury of, oh, I want to write a book about a story about this. It doesn't really connect to any of the other stories, but I want to write it and I can because all of the stories are set in wildly different time periods. Whereas having the kind of more strict, like, oh, this is going to follow on, means that I know whether the character is left, so I know where the character is going to start the story, or who she's going to maybe be with, or where she's going to be. But it restricts me a bit more to, I can't just go, oh, well, I want to write this story. And then I look at my timeline and I go, oh, but that happens 50 years later or something like that. And it's like, okay, well, I can't write that story now. I have to wait a little bit, or I write it in the elder timeline rather than the younger. And so, yeah, I've planned vaguely a fair bit ahead. And yeah, like I said earlier, I've got a document of stories that are either titles, just titles and nothing else, or a one or two sentence description of what is going to happen in it. And quite often when I start writing a new Shield Maiden book, I will look at that list and go, right, is there anything from here that will immediately work and fit what I'm trying to achieve? Because I still want, as much as they are continuing narratives, I still want each book to be kind of approachable as the first book that you read, so that you can look at it and go, oh, well, yes, if you've read book 1, 2, and 3, you're definitely going to get more out of reading book 4. But if you read book 4 without any of the previous knowledge, I still want it to be understandable and you to be able to follow, even if you're just following it from the idea of, oh, these are three separate stories about this one character, kind of like they're presented in the first book. So yeah,
that's a very kind of like great deal of fairness to any new readers coming along, because of course, hopefully with Kickstarter 4 now live, I'm going to throw money at as soon as this video goes live, people will be able to order back copies, I assume, of 1, 2, and 3.
Yes. Brilliant. So yeah, I've got digital and physical like copies of the first three volumes as well as the fourth one.
Brilliant. And what artists are you working with on volume 4?
Oh, now you're gonna make me pronounce names that I've only ever seen written. Right. I'm working with Laura Helsby, who did work on, they did a pin-up for book 3, and I've been wanting to work with them a while. And so they are working on a story that is set in the younger Shield Maiden's timeline, that takes place just after Through Pain and Suffering from book 3. They are being coloured by JP Jordan, who did the colours on Through Pain and Suffering. I very much, when I get when I work with someone I like working with, I tend to work with them again, as you can see from both of those. Then there is a story that is in the Elder timeline that is taking place just after the story from book 1, A Bounty Paid, if I remember the titles correctly. Yes. So it takes place just after that, and that will be illustrated by Rachel Tubb, who is a British artist that I've seen. I can't remember what her book was called. I think it's called Metal Saga. That could be wrong. But did a very cool kind of like fantasy-esque book that I read that I really enjoyed. And then the smaller interstitial story that's set kind of outside of those two timelines is going to be illustrated by a French artist who first name's easy, Alice, and I think it's Lacerte. And then they are going to be coloured by a colourist that I worked with on book 2 called Fabi Marquez. And she will be, or they both will be working on a story set in the middle that is set back when Shield Maiden is a bit younger than either of the timelines, and when she's with Queen Alsa. So it's kind of like a story that's more thematically appropriate for the book, and it's just kind of showing them and their life together, because obviously from book 3 we know that she dies at the beginning of book three. So this is obviously taking place before that, kind of in between book two and book three.
Fabulous. Oh, that all sounds very exciting. I look forward to seeing both the returning artists and the new artists and the lettering and the colouring, because they're all so distinctive. I think that's why I quite liked... my notes keep disappearing. Mm-hmm. Where are they? A Matter of Fate. I keep wanting to say When Fate Decided, but it's not mm-hmm. quite the same title.
Yeah.
In that one, just because it was so striking out of all the other stories in that. Yeah. But there's one question that's always been... teasing my mind, and it'll be interesting to see whether you can and what your answer is.
Sure.
When deciding to do this, do kind of like a Western style Viking saga adventure, did you always intend for it to be a woman and thus a shield maiden, when it could have easily just been a lone Viking warrior going off and having these ventures? What made you decide to make her a woman?
That is a great question that I don't think I have an interesting answer to. She was always a woman. There was never a point where I kind of like changed her sex at all or swapped it around. I just thought it was more interesting. It is, although they are historically debated, I thought it was interesting that it's one of the cultures where there are... like female fighters are kind of slightly more accepted, whether historically accurate or not. I've seen a lot of stuff either way. I don't really have a kind of interesting, oh, this is definitely why I did it. I wanted to show this thing. I just thought that's it was cool. Fine.
Because I guess it leads me to my second one. Like, did you do much research into shield maidens within the original source texts, or even kind of, I guess, mythology to a degree, because I've read a lot of Norse fantasy and I am finding more and more Viking-y comics. And there is one I'll mention to you to see if you've actually come across that one, which has echoes of yours to a degree. But a lot
is it
of
eternal?
Read that one, yes, but there's another one called Sword Daughter.
Oh, okay. I've not heard of that actually.
I will pull it off my shelf. It echoes yours a lot.
Oh, okay, cool.
It's got a similar theme and of, without spoiling too much, a daughter of a father who is shamed when his village gets burned and they lose their mother, and she decides to take up his sword. And again, that timeline jumps about a lot, but it doesn't kind of like get mixed up. It just takes leapfrogs throughout her life. Okay. So you kind of see her go up and become very much a shield maiden like this one.
Oh, cool.
And it also deals with the same kind of like pagan versus Christians, because I do mm-hmm. like that you've acknowledged that even from the very first story in volume one.
Yeah.
So I remember there was that, I think her name was Freydis. I can't remember the other character. The shield maiden helps when dealing with some...
Ingrid.
Ingrid, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. But she and us, you, because it's your words, put it so well about how the Christian culture is taking over the Norse one, and so that soon they'll all be left as stories. And I thought, oh, that's so poignant, so powerful, just so in a nutshell of what they must have felt like.
So that was something actually that when I was adding in the kind of the Western genre elements of the stories, that was something that I kind of really latched onto as well, because it's very similar to a period of kind of like early like Western American history called the Taming of the West. And it's the idea of civilized people coming over to America and taming the Wild West, bringing in industry and what they perceive to be like civilization. And I found it very much reflected the idea of Christians going into kind of more like pagan places and bringing Christianity with them and kind of like forcing it upon and changing the culture for their own gain, essentially. And I thought that was really interesting how it reflected in both the idea of the Wild West being changed and then also Norse Scandinavia being changed. I thought they reflected each other really well, so wanted to make sure that was a thread that was kind of constantly there, even if it's not necessarily in every story. It's something that is aware of, because it's something that is also in kind of slightly more lightly in A Matter of Fate, where the Jarl talks about the king becoming Christian and wanting the Volva and the people who practice like the Sather magic to be eliminated. And it isn't necessarily done by the Jarl as something of like a, oh, I must do this because I like it is my faith now. It's more done as a, oh, I got to do this because if I do it, it'll impress the guy who is Christian. And I thought that was really interesting, and kind of having that lie there in the background of that's how the world is starting to change. And I think especially in the older Shield Maiden timeline, as we kind of like get further into that, that will probably become a bit more prevalent as that change begins to happen in her world, as well as it did historically.
Well, no, I remember reading that, and it was just the way he phrased it, I think. Excuse me. It's like, oh, when they come to baptize us, let us sacrifice this vulva to show much how much we love their new god. And I'm thinking, that's so backwards. And equally, I don't think the monks and the priests coming to baptize you will find it that appealing. But yeah, if you want to, you want to do that, go for it, kind of thing. But it's true. It makes me think of a historical anecdote, and I'm probably going to get the king's name wrong. It was when France wasn't France, but it's separate feuding kingdoms, and it was united under Charlemagne. And then when he died, it passed to his three sons. I think one of them was called Charles the Bald. And I remember reading in one of my many historical books up above my, but he was trying to appease the Vikings to not basically raid his lands. He said, oh, come baptize you and then we'll welcome you to the faith. And look, you can get this nice silk robe as you do. And so they kept coming back. He'd like be baptizing the same people because they'd come get the robes, go again, and get the robes and go again. He ran out of robes, which I thought that's the Vikings. They are opportunists. They are the magpies of humanity, I do often think. So they're the most adaptable and everything. But going back to why she's a Shield Maiden, did you do any research into Shield Maidens in history? Because of course you've mentioned how it is debated, and in 2017 the Birka warrior became a warrior to warrioress because science evolved and actually did better coding on their DNA and bones and whatnot. But she's one of very, very few, and of course it's a matter of debate, because although she was buried with these things, we don't know if they were hers or if she just likes them.
Yeah, so I mean, I definitely did some. I didn't want to get bogged down in, again, like we kind of talked about earlier, getting bogged down too much in, oh, this has to be perfectly historically accurate, because if it did, none of the books would exist. That's true. And so I did enough, I think, that I was confident to write the character, and knowing, especially from the first book, knowing that it was always going to enter a mythology area, I felt kind of a bit freer with what I could do. But yeah, I mean, this was actually after I had already started, but I read a really interesting book that I'm going to not remember what it's called. I think it's called Valkyrie, the like Life and Times of Viking Women, or something like that.
I've got it.
I'm sure you probably do, yeah.
I have Valkyrie, this one. 1 second, this one?
Yes, that one. That's the
I've literally one. Just finished reading it. I've had it since 2020. It's taken me a while. Parenthood, viewers, it ruins your reading.
But yeah, I thought that was really interesting. And her, if I remember rightly, her view is very much that there weren't Viking warriors, but that women were important in a different way. And they still had... restrictions, and but they still also had kind of things that they could do that in the rest of the Western world were very uncommon. And so I thought that was really interesting. But I did read that after the fact. But yeah, I did, like with all of Shield Maiden, I did some historical research, but I'm not a historian by any means. I write made up stories. So I let it inform things, but I don't necessarily let it massively restrict me too much.
I think that's why Norse fantasy dominates my bookshelves, because it's different interpretations, different uses, the mythology and indeed the history, because they're both so entwined with each other. You can't really have Vikings without Thor, you can't have a Hond helmet without having a Shield Maiden. Although shield maidens are probably more slightly accurate than horned helmet, which is definitely not never happened.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no such thing as a horned
that's
helmet.
That's seemingly the only thing that everyone who has a mild interest in Viking history is agreed on, that horned helmets never existed. That's like the only one that everybody is on the same level. Everyone's like, yes, this is the one thing, but everything else is like always up for debate. Some things are different depending on which translation. But yeah, I do find it funny that is the one thing that everyone's like, no, horned helmets are wrong.
And I think that's why I like Norse fantasy in particular, although I do like my historical fiction. I've got loads of that above my shelf as well. Just the way we can experience their culture and their world, both historical and mythical, through either having different points of view, different narrators, different contexts. And the way I've always described fantasy, it's the ideal environment where you ask the question, what if, and then you can get the answer and run with it. Because there's no one in the realm of fantasy that can say, nope, that didn't happen, because it's fantasy, it's made up, it's imaginary. But it explores so much of what makes us all human, because besides like Shield Maidens, a lot of my historical fiction is mainly the men. It's always the men that go raving, have adventures. Mm-hmm. There are female characters, but they don't necessarily get as proactive as this one does. The only other type of female character that does get as active as Shield Maiden is Valkyries, who feature a lot in about 14 out of my 99 red list so far.
Mm-hmm.
And I just love how they, especially with their role of how they kind of like interact with the human world in the afterlife, at the point of death to the afterlife, they act as the ideal character that can explore both the human world and the mythological at the same time, because they do cross that border. They can go in between. And
yeah,
so I'm interested to see where Shield Maiden goes now
that she knows
a certain thing.
I think it's also interesting as well that, and this is the same for a lot of Viking history, but the idea of how kind of popular the Valkyries have like become, but how little there is actually about them in kind of like Norse and Viking history is very interesting. And I think that is almost key to their popularity, is that because there's so little very specific stuff about them, they can be interpreted in like a wide variety of ways. And I think there's a lot of stuff that you can do that with Viking history. There's not like this plethora of like very exact, up-to-date, very strict records of this happened exactly then and this was done by this person and that kind of thing. And it does make and then because the mythology side of Norse culture is very intrinsically linked with their history, it makes writing it historically very difficult, because there's always going to be an element of that mythology in there. But if you are like doing it as a more fantasy realm, which the Shield Maiden books essentially are, it does make it easier, and it gives, especially I feel as a writer, it gives me a lot more freedom to be okay with dropping some of the historical stuff and going, oh yeah, we're going to just delve into mythology very deeply here, and it doesn't feel out of place. I think that was something that I really wanted to make sure was, I didn't want to, especially with book three has so much of it, I didn't want to have book three come out and it'd be like, oh, this is like changed entirely and it's like a wildly different book now. I wanted it to always still feel the same, but then it's just, oh, there is some mythology to this this character in this story. And it's something that you can still continue with without feeling like the book has changed drastically.
Yeah, I think you've captured that really well. And the jump isn't too much of a jump when it comes, because it's dropped at in different hints throughout throughout all three volumes. And of course, I'm eager to see where it goes next in volume four. But it's made me think kind of like the way the Vikings heard these stories or told them, it was very much almost like a lived experience. Like you'd see kind of like, it's thunder and lightning, oh, it's going to be Thor knocking giants, oh, there's big waves on the beach, oh, it's Rand's daughters, they're in a frenzy, and kind of thing. I mean, even in Iceland, even today, when they build new roads, and I'm not sure if this is an urban myth, but it's what I'm going to stick to, I'm sure they check for fairy mounds, or leave an offering to the fairies in case, or they dig around fairy mounds, they never disturb the fairies, never disturb the fairies. And that's a strange thing as well, but it just shows how these beliefs and traditions and perceptions carry on. And one of the things about the Norse legends in particular, they've been so able to stay so prevalent in society for tens, more or less a full millennium or so, at least, since at least Iceland became Christian in 1000 AD. It's just their adaptability. They're as adaptable as the people themselves are to just surviving, keeping going, and that kind of thing. And I love it, and I loved it especially when I came across it through. But I mean, I love the Viking Age history, and I love the mythology, and you bring it so together beautifully in your writing and working with so many different talented artists, and I cannot wait for volume four. Will there possibly be any chance of you having them at Thought Bubble Comic Con this November?
That, or that is the plan. Yeah, that is the plan. So so the Kickstarter is now and then I'm hoping that for Thought Bubble will be the kind of like physical like launch. Like I'll get everything shipped out to backers, and then I'll have them in my hand, ready to show people at Thought Bubble in November.
Yes. So there you go. You've heard it, dear viewers and dear listeners. If you want to go meet Acer in person to pick up any of the volumes, I'm sure I'll have a selection of 1, 2, and 3 on display as well. And of course, get your copy signed. So you don't, if you don't want to do the Kickstarter, that's fine. I won't begrudge you, but go to Thought Bubble Comic Con anyway, because there's not just Acer there. There's thousands of really wonderful artists and creatives there. Yeah. And it's, if you love comics and comic art and comic writing, Thought Bubble is the place to go. MCM doesn't have a smidge on Thought Bubble Comic Con. It really doesn't. And that's in November in Harrogate. Gosh, well, we have talked about so much, and I'm run out of questions amazingly because we've leapfrogged around so many different ideas and themes and issues. Thank you again for creating this wonderful series. I wish you the best of luck with volume four. I hope the Kickstarter flies off like Valkyrie into the sunset and brings glory and fame to you and the wonderful artists you've been working so delicately with over the next month and months to come, as it all gets pulled together so beautifully. The link will be down below. Listeners and readers, go click, go throw money at it, even if it's just £1, just to keep him going, because I certainly will. And yes, it's available via the Kickstarter, or go see Acer at Thought Bubble in November. Thank you very much for joining me, Acer.
Thank you very much for having me. It has been lovely to chat all things Shieldmate.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.